I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. In a moment, a conversation about Iraqi refugees. Will the world step up to take them in? But first, temperatures are soaring today here on the East Coast. They're rising 10 to 15 degrees above normal in Pennsylvania, Ohio, and Illinois, and the thermometer hit triple digits in Oregon. But as air conditioners blast, a new report from the International Energy Agency in Paris says industrialized countries are going to face an unprecedented energy crunch by 2012, just 5 years from now. Javier Blas is covering the story for the Financial Times in London. And Javier, we've spoken about this issue before. We know China and India are adding to the demand on fuel. But give us a sense of what the report says we might pay for a barrel of oil.
Well, what analysts are saying is that if the International Energy Agency is right with the new numbers, and if consumption is really rising faster than supply, we are going to see $100 pretty soon.
Well, but the thinking when a barrel of oil went to $70 or $80 was that people would drive less, they wouldn't pay.
But we are driving basically the same amount of miles. We are using, as you say, the air conditioner. We are consuming oil as nothing happens. People 5 years ago said $40 and demand will drop. 2 years ago was $60 and demand will drop. Last year was $80 and demand will drop, and nothing is happening. So what analysts think is that prices need to rise more than today's level to get a drop in demand.
Well, analysts are projecting a 2.2% increase in demand.
That means 1.9 million extra barrels a day. That means three times the Alaska production. That's a lot of oil in our world, especially when the supply from non-OPEC countries is going to rise only 1% a year. That's the problem.
Well, the report makes a distinction between OPEC members and non-OPEC producers when it comes to supply. What does the report say?
Non-OPEC producers are the traditional producers that we are used to, say Texas, say Mexico, say the North Sea here. That's a production where we are struggling to keep the increase. In some areas, the production is even in decline. OPEC is the countries in Middle East, is Nigeria, is Venezuela. For those countries, oil is the national industry. The countries in OPEC where we can increase really the production have an interest in not increasing the production to keep high the prices.
And what does the report say to the members of OPEC?
Please increase the production right now. That's the very short-term message to OPEC. The long-term view, say, in the 5 years, please increase your investment in new production, because for the next 5 years, we are going to need more oil from you. That's the two messages, one in the short term, one in the long term.
Has OPEC, traditionally had, sort of a spare, had more capacity, and is that now dwindling? Is that one of the problems?
That's right. That's the other problem. OPEC and especially Saudi Arabia used to have a spare capacity, and that was our cushion. We used to have, 10 years ago, about 5 million barrels a day of a spare capacity. It was more than three times the production of the Gulf of Mexico. Right now, spare capacity is really small, and the International Energy Agency is projecting that will be about 1 million barrels a day in 5 years' time. With that spare capacity, any problem in the supply chains, and we got prices rising.
How much does the instability in the region where most of the OPEC members are, the war in Iraq, which you mentioned, how much do these different issues impact this analysis? What are the concerns 5 years down the road?
Oh, it's key. It's absolutely key. Let me say, just concentrate in two countries, Iraq and Iran. That's countries that everyone in the industry agrees that in 2 years, if everything were fine and we have a political situation conducted through investment, we have a peaceful situation, we have no war at all, these countries could be producing together about 10 million barrels a day. That's not the situation right now. If there is not a solution for Iraq and Iran, it's even more likely that we are going to suffer high oil prices in 5 years.
Yeah. Javier, we see analysts reacting to this report with a lot of concern. But I'm wondering, is there sort of a danger of a Chicken Little factor here? Because many Americans might feel, well, we've heard this news before. What's different and new about this report?
The new is that it's not a warning. It's a reality. 2 years ago, it was a risk. Yesterday, what they said is we have a problem. It's not a warning. It's just a reality.
Javier Blas of the Financial Times in London speaking about the new report from the International Energy Agency in Paris, which says that industrialized countries will face an unprecedented energy crunch by 2012. Javier, thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Well, Iraq is the dominant issue again before Congress as lawmakers continue debate on the war funding bill. Today, they also heard from Republican presidential candidate John McCain. McCain recently returned from a trip to Iraq. Today, he fired his campaign manager and chief strategist, then spoke to the Senate about his continued support of the war, warning that pulling out of Iraq now could echo what followed U.S. withdrawal from Vietnam.
Many who supported that withdrawal in the name of human rights did not foresee the calamity that followed, which included genocide in Cambodia, tens of thousands slaughtered in Vietnam by the North Vietnamese, and the tragedy of hundreds of thousands of boat people.
As in Vietnam, hundreds of thousands of Iraqis are fleeing their country, including the first big wave, which is arriving in the U.S. right now. Under pressure, the Bush administration agreed to accept 7,000 Iraqis this year, a huge jump over the 700 accepted during the first 3 years of the war, but hardly a dent in the millions who have fled Iraq since 2003. So how big a problem is the Iraq refugee situation? Joost Hilterman is Deputy Program Director for the Middle East for the International Crisis Group. He joins us with an overview of the refugee situation, and we also want to talk to you about your new book. It's about the awful story of the gassing of Kurds in Iraq in 1988. We're going to do that as well, but welcome to you.
Thank you.
How can we see this? How bad is the refugee situation?
Well, we talked 700 in the United States, now up to 7,000. We're talking about at least 700,000 in Jordan, which is a country of less than 6 million people. It's a huge strain on the resources of that country. We have an even larger number in Syria, which is a fairly poor country. And so for the region already, the Iraqi refugee crisis is an immediate problem that can only get worse as the situation in Iraq deteriorates.
Well, and how are they treated? I mean, countries have different policies towards refugees. We understand that Syria and Lebanon and Jordan as well consider Iraqis guests rather than refugees. So what happens? What's their status? How do they live?
Their status is uncertain. They could be picked up at any point and be put across the border back into Iraq, which is a very dangerous situation for them, of course.
Is this because these three states didn't sign the 1951 Refugees Convention, the UN?
It's because they want to keep the refugees off balance so that they do not organize, protest their conditions, speak out in any way, shape or form.
Because they don't know what their status is.
That's right.
At any time. We in the States are learning about the different allegiances in the region. So how does each country view Iraqis and thus Iraqi refugees?
They understand that the situation in Iraq is untenable for these people. At the same time, pressures are building up, resentment is building up. And guests have a way of outstaying their welcome, of course. And this is going to happen sooner or later. And these people are not about to return to Iraq. It may be a matter of years, if not decades, before they're able to return.
Are they allowed to work? Are they allowed to go to school?
Well, it differs from Jordan to Syria, where the main refugee populations are. In Jordan, they are allowed to work, but it's not encouraged. No employment is made available to them. And kids cannot go to public schools. They can go to private schools if the parents can afford it. In Syria, the kids are allowed to go to public schools, but the absorption capacity there is so low that effectively the same percentage of refugee children are going to school in Syria as do in Jordan to private schools, and that's less than 10%.
We know as well that Iraqis are not all, you know, a monolith. Different factions within this refugee population. So what are the different problems for different Iraqi refugees?
The main problem is Christians, who are a small minority, who feel particularly threatened and who don't feel at home in Jordan or Syria, which are not predominantly Christian countries, even though they, of course, too have Christian minorities. The problem is acute for Shiites who come to Jordan, where they are not wanted and where people upon entry into the country are asked, are you a Sunni or a Shiite? Of course, everybody says they're Sunni.
We understand, too, that this refugee situation is particularly tough for Palestinians who were favored under Saddam Hussein, had favored housing. He supported their cause. We know he, you know, sent monies to Palestinian families. And now they're left with no benefactor.
It's terrible what has happened to them. Many have been stranded at the Jordanian-Iraqi border for the last few years and are still there, and no country that's willing to take them.
The U.S. has been criticized for not doing more. Refugees International says that the U.S. should lead an international initiative to support these countries that are hosting Iraqi civilians. But, you know, one of the countries is Syria. Refugees International recommends that the U.S. help Syria keep its borders open to, you know, help these refugees move back and forth. Well, you know, the Bush administration feels, and many analysts feel, that some of the insurgents are coming across the Syria border.
Right. So close the border, open the border, close the border. Nobody knows. It's an impossible situation to be in for Syria.
You know, we're speaking of the Iraqis that will come to the U.S. soon as well. And people are saying there should be more. All the Iraqis that supported the U.S.-led coalition are potentially in danger now. Is that the answer? Is that the answer to take people out of their country and ship them somewhere else?
Well, if the humanitarian crisis deepens, then there may not be any better option. But the real objective should be to stabilize Iraq. But I think we're probably beyond that now. And in fact, we're talking about X number of refugees now in surrounding countries, but that number is certain to rise as these various wars that are raging in Iraq escalate, intensify over the coming year.
An Iraqi journalist just quoted in the Refugees International press release as saying that the Iraqis who are remaining in Iraq are just queuing in line, waiting to die. To be given refugee status, somebody has to show that they were persecuted in their home country or in danger in their home country. Isn't that correct? And so who would it be? All Iraqis at a certain point?
Well, almost all Iraqis. You can leave out the Kurdish region for now because it's still relatively peaceful and stable. But outside that, we're talking about some 20 million Iraqis who are at risk, yes, from active fighting, warfare in their neighborhoods.
Yeah. What do you think is the answer to the refugee problem?
Well, there are never clear answers to refugee problems. People end up sitting for long periods of time in tent encampments on borders in horrible conditions, and you know, these camps become themselves radicalized and may give rise to you know, problems down the line. The only solution really is for people to go back to their homes, and for that you need to have a modicum of stability. But in Iraq, I don't see that as a short-term option.
I mean, what would you say to Americans in particular who might say, we already have an immigration problem, we already have people taking jobs, we just can't handle this?
When you fight a war of choice, not a war of necessity, and then you let it go awry so badly as it has gone, then I think there is a moral responsibility on the part of the United States and the other countries, including my own, the Netherlands, that were part of this coalition, to absorb a good number of the refugees, especially those who stuck their necks out by working for the coalition forces, who are now exposed either in danger in Iraq or in uncertain positions in neighboring states.
And as you pointed out, the problem is much more widespread. Sweden was taking in thousands of Iraqis. You congratulated them, in fact, but now they're finding it hard to accommodate them. So Sweden has announced they're going to make it more difficult for Iraqis to seek asylum. We're talking with Joost Hilderman from the International Crisis Group. When we come back, connections between chemical attacks during the Iraq-Iran war by Saddam Hussein and the situation in the region today. And later in the show, don't forget, we're going to take a look at this standoff over executive privilege in the White House. Back after a break here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now, and we're back with more from Joost Hilderman. He is Deputy Program Director for the Middle East for the International Crisis Group. We've been speaking about the Iraqi refugee crisis. Now, Joost's new book is A Poisonous Affair, America, Iraq, and the Gassing of Halabja. We want to talk about that as well, because I think it does bring us back to the issue of today's refugees. Joost, in the book, you focus on Saddam Hussein's mustard gas attack on that Kurdish town, Halabja, in 1988. This is 8 years into the war with Iran. The Iranians were supporting the Kurds in Halabja when Saddam attacked. Horrific images from that attack. We remember those. But in your research, you also explored chemical attacks by Saddam and his forces before Halabja and in other areas, in Iran in particular. You spoke to a survivor of an Iraqi attack in 1987 on the Iranian Kurdish town of Sardasht. More than 100 people were killed. Thousands were injured. Could you just read us a passage describing what this woman survivor told you?
when Iranian troops encamped nearby suddenly donned gas masks as the chemical attack got underway, many townspeople did not even know what these outfits were for. When soldiers started running through the streets yelling "chemical attack," we had no idea what they meant. The attack around 4 in the afternoon caught her unawares, standing at the door of her home in the town's southern part, and when the bombs began to fall, she realized that her son was somewhere outside. I started running to look for him near the cinema, but suddenly my legs began to feel really hot. I thought this must be from the running, but when I looked down, they looked as if someone had poured boiling water over them. She found her son, then returned home to fetch her daughter Shaveen, 5 years old at the time, and together they made their way to Lale Park, where men were burning car tires to create fires and minimal protection against gas exposure. Soldiers were going around with loudspeakers saying that people should move north to the elevated areas. They said everyone should leave, but we didn't have a car, so we stayed.
As you went back to find what really happened in both Halabja and the other attacks, I mean, as you write, you're thinking what I'm thinking, which is, why didn't we know about this sooner? Why didn't we know about this sooner?
The enormity of it was never conveyed in the media at the time. And this was in part because we were dealing with a war situation, and there is such a thing as the fog of war, and it's very unclear what is going on, and journalists don't generally have good access. And secondly, it was a war between two countries that were notoriously closed societies, Iran and Iraq.
Was it also difficult because at the time the Reagan administration was supporting Iraq in the war against Iran? Maybe there was an inclination to think that perhaps it wasn't as clear that Iraq was doing this as opposed to Iran.
The Reagan administration took advantage of the fog of war to cast aspersions on both sides. And in the Halabja attack in 1988, the Reagan administration went further to actually obfuscate what had happened, suggesting that Iran, in fact, was partially responsible for the gassing victims in Halabja. Well, this clearly was not the case.
Because as your research and other analysis points out, the Iranians were aligned with the people in
That's
the
right.
Town.
The Iranians had no interest in using chemical weapons at the time. But more than that, I've interviewed people on all sides, on the Iranian side, medical doctors, on the Kurdish side, victims and Peshmergas who were fighting in the area, and on the Iraqi side, officers, Iraqi officers in the former army. And it becomes very clear that no one is arguing that Iran used chemical weapons in Halabja.
What are some of the consequences of Halabja itself and the muddying of it? You write, for instance, that when the U.S. didn't react as strongly against Iraq, Iran read that message as, well, we better arm ourselves.
Yeah, I think that the Iranian chemical and biological and maybe nuclear weapons programs should be attributed to its experience in the Iran-Iraq war, where it was exposed for 5 years to Iraqi chemical attacks, when it complained to the United Nations about it in formal ways and received absolutely no response from the Security Council, except more accusations that Iran itself had also participated in these attacks. And so there was a total distrust of the international community, even as Iran feels that it needs to arm itself in order to protect itself from these kinds of traumatic attacks.
You've been someone who's been highly critical of the way the U.S.-led coalition has waged the war in Iraq, especially since your work is with refugees and you're seeing this crisis now. But how do you respond to people who would even look at your book title and even hear what we're talking about and saying, that's exactly why what Saddam Hussein did to the Kurds, gassing the Kurds with this awful mustard gas, is exactly why the U.S. needed to invade, the conflation of...
Yeah, of course. It was a terrible regime. And many of my Iraqi friends, of course, desperately wanted to get rid of this regime. It was just that the United States was the wrong agent to bring about the regime's demise because it had such a compromised past in Iraq, and also because military intervention in the Middle East doesn't appear to solve any problems. It seems to aggravate them.
Where are they now? Again, because people conflate, you know, he had the weapons, he used this mustard gas against people in 1988. So those are the weapons of mass destruction that we had to go to war to eliminate.
Well, the chemical agents have gone bad. I mean, they don't. You can't keep them on the shelf that long. But more importantly, the United Nations Special Commission on Iraq, UNSCOM, totally dismantled the Iraqi weapons of mass destruction programs in the 1990s. And there simply were no chemical weapons left. And anything that was found after 2003 was useless material. That the Iraqis was just sort of somewhere on a dump still, but could not be used in any way, shape or form.
Meanwhile, it was Kurdish Iraqis who were gassed at Halabja. Ironically, they seem to be the ones least likely to be refugees, to be part of this population we began by talking about.
Well, it's a paradox. In 1991, because of their fear of a repeat of Halabja, they fled in great numbers. Many got into Iran, and Turkey would not allow them in. And in response to that, the United States set up a safe haven, which then turned into essentially the Kurdish Autonomous Region, an enclave from where they have lived since late 1991 and have had virtual independence. So it's a total paradox that this has happened. And now, after the removal of the regime, of course, this region has become enormously strengthened. And the question is really, how will they manage it now?
Joost Hilderman, Deputy Program Director for the Middle East for the International Crisis Group. His new book is A Poisonous Affair, America, Iraq, and the Gassing of Halabja. Joost, thanks as always for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Okay, quick look at tomorrow on Here and Now. Call it Sex in the Arab City. We'll speak to the author of a book that's creating a firestorm in the Arab world. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. The Washington Post is reporting today that when Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez told the Senate in 2005 there has not been one verified case of civil rights abuse by the FBI because of the Patriot Act, he had on his desk an FBI report saying just the opposite, that FBI agents had obtained personal information they were not entitled to have. Justice Department officials said they could not determine if the Attorney General had actually read the report, but the revelation that he had it came as Congress continues its investigation into the alleged politicization of the Justice Department. Yesterday, in a separate case, the president asserted he had executive privilege to withhold documents and stop two former aides from testifying before the House and Senate Judiciary Committees looking into the firing of federal prosecutors. This sets up a possible contempt of Congress citation. What exactly does that mean? Well, we're joined now by George Washington University School Law Professor Jonathan Turley. Jonathan, welcome as always.
Thanks, Robin.
Let's talk about the Gonzalez aspect of the story. The context of the Attorney General's testimony in 2005 is that Congress was considering whether to renew the Patriot Act. The Attorney General was testifying in favor of its renewal and reassuring worried senators there had been no civil rights violations because of Patriot Act powers. So, but what is being reported about reports that he had in hand?
Well, it's a particularly damaging disclosure because, as you have noted, during that period, Gonzalez was saying that he's kept very close attention to this area and whether abuse has occurred. And we now know that he received a report days earlier saying that, in fact, abuses had occurred. But also in a larger context, Gonzalez now has what seems to be an ever-expanding list of false or misleading statements to Congress. This one seems one of the more egregious, but it's one of many. And so part of the dilemma right now in Washington is what Congress is going to do about it. You have someone who has become a recidivist, that over and over again he's been shown to have given false information or misleading information to Congress. Members of both parties have objected, have called for his resignation. The question now is, what are they going to do about it?
Well, what can they do about it?
Well, they can impeach him. I mean, you can impeach not just a president. You can impeach a cabinet officer. It hasn't been done in history in terms of attempts very much, but it has been attempted in the past. It is within their authority. Gonzalez has been accused of crimes with regard to the domestic surveillance program. He's also been accused of obstruction of Congress. Those are the types of things that would be impeachable offenses. The question is not whether Congress has the ability to do something. The question is whether Congress has the intestinal fortitude to do something.
Especially in the time frame that we're in, heavy debate over the war in Iraq and presidential campaigns beginning. And it comes, as we said, amid a broad invocation of executive privilege by the Bush administration. Former White House political director Sarah Taylor was scheduled to testify before Congress tomorrow, I believe, and former White House counsel Harriet Myers was scheduled to give testimony on Thursday. Now, first of all, we know that President Bush has directed them not to speak, but they can still speak, can't they?
They can. It's a very interesting situation because they're no longer employed, obviously, in the executive branch. But former officials are expected to follow the directions of the president on executive privilege. It's considered a major no-no for a former official to testify when the president has said he considers this covered by executive privilege. They are not required, however, to follow that direction. If they indicate that they will testify, the president would have to go to court to enjoin their testimony. And in fact, that's probably the fairest thing to do here. That is, rather than have Congress hold them in contempt, it would be better for the president to take his case to the court. Otherwise, the more traditional approach would be for Congress to hold both of these people in contempt if they refuse to testify.
Now, let's back up. By the way, they would be testifying into questions about the firing of federal prosecutors. Tell us about this contempt of Congress citation. What exactly is it? Do they have to, does Congress, how do they decide to invoke it?
Well, Congress can hold you in contempt if you refuse to testify, particularly after being given immunity.
I guess the question is because we've read several reports, one of which said that Congress was going to push the courts to cite the aides, and others said that Congress was going to vote to decide whether or not to have a contempt of Congress citation. So,
well, the correct way to do it is for the committee to vote on contempt, and then goes to the full House, which votes, and usually submits this to the Department of Justice. That is, the entire House will approve the contempt citation, and it goes to the Department of Justice to prosecute. If the Department of Justice refuses to prosecute, Congress does have the inherent authority to then go to a court and ask the court to hold the person in contempt on their own authority.
Right.
But we're getting into some choppy water.
Right. Well, that's just, it gives us a sense of the process. And that, I guess, is what some people are saying is the dilemma for the Democrats in particular on the Senate Judiciary Committee. This all sounds like it takes time.
Well, it takes time, it takes will, but I think when you look at how low the polls are of Congress, eventually these people are going to have to get an understanding that the reason the public holds them in such low regard is because they don't do anything. That every time they run on things like ethics in government, the Iraq War, none of those promises were fulfilled. They never did carry out any of those changes. It was just too tough. Now you've got someone like Gonzalez who has just publicly made a mockery of Congress, and there's been no response from Congress in a meaningful way, and on this issue as well. So I think that there is growing discontent with Congress that, you know, particularly the Democrats, you know, the American people put you into power, and you've yet to really use it.
Well, part of what the White House is saying here is that communications White House officials have with people outside the White House are also covered by executive privilege. The documents they're withholding are logs of phone calls and emails. It's one of the points of contention between the Congress and the White House. How does it get resolved?
Well, ultimately it would be resolved by the courts. You know, executive privilege is not mentioned in the Constitution. It is a creation of the courts. And the Supreme Court has not looked at this since 1974 in the Nixon case. So it's remained very ambiguous. And for that reason, many presidents have tried not to let these things get into court in deference to their successors, because the courts created this privilege and they can reduce it. But in 1974, eight justices, all eight voting on that case, they were short one, said that whatever executive privilege is, and they recognize that it exists, it can be trumped by a grand jury or by Congress when they are looking for criminal evidence and when they don't have any other source for the information. Well, Congress has laid out a pretty good case that they fit that exemption or exception.
Jonathan Turley, you got about 20 seconds. What do you think is going to happen here?
I think Congress has finally been pushed too far, and they're going to go to court. But I think the president is relying more on the calendar than the Constitution. He's going to try to run this out.
Jonathan Turley, professor of public interest law at George Washington University. We'll see. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Robin.
And before we go today, Revolution 67, we'll look at Newark, of course, New Jersey, 40 years after its summer of discontent. You're listening to Here and Now. The state of Vermont has just one area code and not a lot of diversity, and both of those facts are sent up in the rap song 802.
Green Mountain State, where we roll on skis. Don't mess with our cows or we'll break your knees.
State of Vermont, where we make Ben and Jerry. Sweet like syrup and our streets aren't scary.
The video for 802 has had over 120,000 hits on YouTube. Who doesn't want to see Vermonters driving a Scion rhyming cheddar extra sharp with our roofs have leaks, so we patch it with a tarp. The song is written and performed by Montpelier High School students Colin Arisman and Luke Martin, a.k.a. C Money and Run Rhymes. They call their group X10. They now have a new song out, CO2. It's a response to Vermont Governor Jim Douglas's veto of a bill to cut emissions in the state. The governor said he doesn't like the bill's tax on the Vermont Yankee nuclear plant, and there's going to be a special session in Vermont tomorrow on this issue. So Colin and Luke join us now with more on their sudden foray into not just rap, but politics. Do you think you've had an impact on this debate?
Well, we hope. We performed it yesterday at a convention with Bernie Sanders, who's our senator.
Bill McKibben was attending.
Yeah.
Bill McKibben, of course, the environmentalist who's very big on sustainability. Here are some of the lyrics that he heard.
Atmosphere filling up with heat, trap, and gas. Living like this, we're never gonna last. Methane flows.
Tell me some of the ways that you feel that global warming is a problem, specifically in Vermont.
Well, the rising temperature will allow mosquitoes to come deeper north, and that increased range brings disease with it.
Like you say, you could get malaria and not even show it.
Production is on the downfall. Vermont soon experiencing sugar withdrawal. Increased spread of lung disease and malaria. If you haven't shown symptoms, you could still be a carrier.
Our forests are suffering from beetles, which are hurting maple trees.
You are in sugar withdrawal up in Vermont.
It also hurts us economically because of the ski season being shortened because there's not as much good snow and stuff.
Right. You show a skier skiing suddenly onto an exposed log or something like that.
That's me.
First of all, I shouldn't presume. You are sending up some things here, aren't you? I mean, you don't really think that you can rap well, do you?
No. Oh. I think Luke's better than I am. I'm awful.
Is it that, you are so the opposite of what we hear about in rap songs? I mean, you'll never hear anyone rapping about our eggs are jumbo because our chickens are free-ranging.
Well, I think the thing about rap is that there's a stereotype that it's going to be about material goods and women. And part of what we were showing was that it's just a way of creating music, and it can really be about anything.
And you've been getting, tremendous response. I was looking at YouTube and some of the comments. For instance, there's somebody who writes, support from the Texas Outpost, excellent work. What is a snowplow? That's from Matt Bruner in Cold Spring, Texas. But you've also been getting some criticism. Here's a guy, and he posted this video on YouTube.
Yeah, I just watched that today.
Oh, boy.
Pretty funny.
Okay.
Wait, what is this? He rap battled us online.
Yes. Let's listen. He's from 10029. That's the zip code for the Bronx.
You fools just prove Vermont is cheesy. Your lyrics are lame and your production is whack. What I'm really saying is that y'all can't rap. I feel pain that I watched and I fell in your trap. Vermont's what happened when the state of Maine took a crap. Sorry.
Whoa!
Nice try.
I'm insulted for you. Colin, Luke, what'd you think of that?
I think he's a lot better at rapping than me.
I think it's funny that he thinks we're serious.
There's not much Maine-Vermont hatred.
Luke, do you have a thought for a new song? Is there something you're working on?
I think we're going to try to work on Tax Day. I don't really know what it's going to be about. But
I wrote a line today while I was on my tractor.
Oh, sick.
What, a tax day?
Tax day. April 15th.
Oh, April 15th. What was the line you wrote while you were on your tractor?
Well, I was listening to some Snoop Dogg, so there's a line that's like, 6:45 was the time on the clock in the Snoop Dogg rap, so then I kind of took that and I wrote, 6:45 was the time on the clock, taxes were due, stuck between a hard place and a rock.
Whoa, I can't wait to hear what 10029 says about that.
He'll love it.
Colin Arisman and Luke Martin are high schoolers in Montpelier, Vermont. They also go by the names See Money and Run Rhymes for their rap group X10. Thanks so much for speaking to us, you guys.
Thank you.
Thank you. 802.
Back in a minute, here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. July of 1967 was the summer of love for some, but it was the summer of discontent for African-American residents in Newark, New Jersey, who watched as tanks rolled through their streets.
This is not Saigon, nor is this a battle in which Americans are defending our country from an invasion by a foreign power. This is Newark, New Jersey, population 400,000. And we are seeing the sights and hearing the sounds of a revolution.
Newark's is the story of other American cities as well. Redlining and real estate deals had led to white flight in a black community with a largely white police force and government. And then on July 12th, Newark police pulled over and beat a black cab driver. Rumors flew that he'd been killed, even though he hadn't died. Residents threw bricks and bottles at the police station. Then there was looting. Fires were set. Then Governor Hughes called in the state police and National Guard. Within 48 hours, gun battles and police beatings were reported. After 6 days, 23 people were dead, more than 700 injured, 1,500 in police custody. Revolution 67 is a documentary of what happened 40 years ago this week. It airs tonight on PBS's POV series. Co-director Mary Lou Tobaldo Buongiorno is with us. Welcome.
Thank you.
We also welcome Dr. Clement Price, an historian from Rutgers University. He is prominently featured in the film, and he's with us from WBGO in Newark, New Jersey. Dr. Price, welcome.
Welcome, Robin.
Dr. Price, there was a rumor of a man senselessly killed, but why else was Newark such a tinderbox?
I cannot think of a city that made more mistakes with its most vulnerable citizens, residents, than did Newark. The reason why it got out of hand, well, we now know. It's very important to make sure that our police officers understand the community that they police, that they have a conversance with the Constitution, and that state troopers and National Guardsmen should be drawn from the population at large.
So the state police, the National Guard, called in by the governor. There's a rumor, Mary Lou, that there are snipers on the street, snipers being a very powerful word in this Vietnam era.
Yes, absolutely. As one of the National Guardsmen states in the film, he was convinced for 40 years that he had been fired upon absolutely by a sniper because of his automatic weapon.
The guardsman's claim, he's now much older, was that it wasn't a policeman or an authority. It had to be a citizen of Newark, because no one ever carried those automatic weapons. And then you find film of policemen carrying automatic weapons.
Exactly. Coming across in the archival footage, seeing that Newark police did have these types of automatic weapons was a revelation to him and to us.
The Hughes Commission, which was an investigation into the Newark riots, found that there was a disproportionate amount of rounds fired by the residents and the police. What was that equation?
150-1. It seems that the shots that were fired by the National Guard were, and they had to account for all of those, were over 13,000 per 100 alleged. And they don't know that for sure.
From the citizens. Well, you speak with residents who were there, such as poet and playwright Amiri Baraka, formerly Leroy Jones. He was pulled over and beaten by police.
At the hospital, the so-called doctor said, "You're the poet." I said, "Yes." He said, "You'll never write any more poetry." And then he proceeded to sew up my head with no painkiller or whatever that was. He sewed it up. It was one of those scenes. I mean, it was war.
Dr. Price, there's another moment in the film that seems that it tells of a turning point when a young man named Billy Furr was shot and killed in front of a white photographer named Bud Lee and a New York Times reporter. Billy Furr and his friends had offered to loot something cold for the New York Times reporter and photographer to drink. Then what happened?
Well, what happens, these guys come out of the store, and two Newark cops come up in a squad car, and they shoot at one of the looters, and the round from their guns hit a kid on the street, and that kid is featured in that rather infamous photograph on the cover of Life magazine.
He's lying on the ground. He appears
right.
to be dead. He's
he
not.
He appears to be dead. He's not dead, but Billy Furr did not survive the round.
Here's that white photographer. Years later, he goes back to Newark to remember what that was like to be standing right there as this happened.
And he died right in front of me. It was just I just couldn't believe that they didn't shoot his legs or something. Why kill the guy, the poor guy, you know?
On the other hand, Mary Lou, you also profile, and we hear from, the white student activists like Tom Hayden.
Yes, they had targeted northern cities to increase voter registration. That was their primary goal.
Were they agitators, instigators?
The definition depends on the point of view. We have a clip of then police captain Spina calling them outside agitators.
It would seem, though, that with the other history that you document, that with or without these activists, Newark was ready to blow.
Yes, absolutely.
And there are at least five major elements at work which are discussed in the film. Actually, the most important was probably not police brutality, although that had quite a history in Newark. The most important element, the most troubling aspect to that summer was the fear that thousands of homes owned by blacks or rented by blacks were about to be bulldozed to make way for a state medical school and hospital.
Well, let's hear a clip of the film. It's a town meeting protesting the medical center proposal.
This proposal has been rammed down the throat of the Negro community, whose homes are going to be razed, and we must not permit this kind of careless attitude to exist in New Jersey or in the city of Newark.
What was it like for you to pour through this footage? I was struck as I was watching it at, for instance, as the residents of Newark, the black residents, gather in their anger over the rumor that somebody had been killed. You see women in white A-line dresses holding their purses and men in their white pressed shirts and slacks. And there seems so much civility prior to suddenly there's tanks rolling down the street of an American city.
Yes, I was struck by that too, exactly for the reasons you just mentioned, because it is a community. You then start to see that these tanks and barbed wire and the city just becomes a war zone. For example, the National Guardsman was actually born and raised in Newark and had just come back from serving overseas and saying that he had never fired a shot or saw any kind of violence being in the military, and yet coming back to his hometown and having this kind of interaction with his neighbors.
So how did it end? And by that I mean, how did it suddenly dissipate?
I think people were exhausted after 4 or 5 days. I think the governor finally realized that the civic leaders in Newark knew more about their town than he did. And he called them to a meeting, which is documented in the film, and they pretty much said, take away the troops, and we believe this community will come to rest. And that's exactly what happened. Now, that's not the coda of the riots. In many ways, Newark has been putting the finishing pieces on that riot over 30 years, mainly through the nation's first Black Power Conference held in Newark, one might say hosted by Newark, and that galvanized black political opinion and behavior. And in 1970, Newark becomes the first major northeastern city to elect a black mayor. As one who teaches a course in the history of Newark, I now see the summer of 1967 as the defining moment in the contemporary history of Newark. We know a lot about how we got to that moment, and we're beginning to learn a lot about how to recover and move away from that moment.
Dr. Clement Price is an historian from Rutgers University. We've also been speaking with Mary Lou Tobaldo Buongiorno, co-director of the film Revolution 67. Again, it airs tonight on PBS's POV series. For more, go to our website, here-now.org. Mary Lou and Dr. Price, thank you both so much.
Thank you,
Rob. I see somebody
watching. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again, Here and Now.
I see somebody watching.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software. On the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.